Welcome to Sense and Sensibility, the Inflation Guy podcast. I am Michael Ashton. I am the Inflation Guy. I'm your host. And wow, we have a good show today. You know, I like to do these podcasts with a topic, right? And so I started writing today, though, thinking, I've got a bunch of little things I need to talk about. But it was only a couple episodes ago, I did an inflation snippets piece. And, you know, occasionally I'll do a potpourri and just sort of talk about different things. But as I started to write today's podcast about a lot of the different things that are happening, it all sort of seemed to come back to sort of one topic and one general theme. And the general theme is that those 10 dangerous words are getting more and more appropriate as we get deeper into this election year. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode of Sense and Sensibility is sponsored by Simplify ETFs, a fast-growing manager of alternative ETFs, solving today's most pressing portfolio challenges. Not only do they have sophisticated diversifying strategies like a managed futures ETF or yield curve plays like TUA, they also have the number one best-performing intermediate core bond fund from 2023 in AGGH and an enhanced income ETF, ticker HIGH, that was in the top 2% of its category. Check out their website at simplify.us. That's simplify.us. You can find their entire lineup of ETFs at simplify.us/ETFs. And this podcast is also sponsored by Enduring Investments. Defend your money. Do I need to say any more than that? Inflation bad. Inflation bad. Need help? Visit us at enduringinvestments.com. I kept that spot a little short because I want to get into it today. I'm very excited, as you can probably tell. So the 10 most dangerous words, and some of you will have already identified this, but the 10 most dangerous words are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. I think that's 10. Yes. And so I have a lot of different things to talk about today, but most of them fall into that category. Why is inflation here to stay, at least for a while? Well, it's partly because big government looks to be here to stay. Now, I might be wrong, but I suspect that while the amount of bigness might change depending on which party ends up taking the legislature and the presidency in the coming election in November, maybe that changes the amount of bigness if it's, you know, Republicans versus Democrats or whatever. But neither party is talking about returning government to the size that it was in the 1990s, which wasn't tiny. So it's still going to be big government, maybe not quite as big or a little bigger, but it's we're not talking about reversing kind of this long-standing trend to bigger and bigger government. And the central bank is reducing the size of its balance sheet. The Fed's reducing the size of the balance sheet, but not to the size it was 10 years ago, which wasn't tiny. That was after the global financial crisis. And after the global financial crisis, the Fed just kept, and all central banks just kept growing and growing and growing their balance sheet. And even now when they are, you know, slowly decreasing the size of their balance sheets a little bit, it ain't, you know, no one's talking about returning it to what it was prior to 2008. So, you know, naturally, that's part of the problem. You get inflation when you get a lot of money growth, but especially, and this is important today, especially when you're changing who is spending that money. Now, I have to give a hat tip here, because this is sort of the thought that made today's episode totally come together. But, and the hat tip is to the Dan Bongino show. Now, I recognize as I do that I'm outing myself as a conservative. Most of you probably had figured that out along the way, but I try hard not to, you know, talk too much about politics as politics. But to be fair, if you're anti-inflation, you're probably already a conservative. You know, that's anyway, on the Dan Bongino show, and there's a link in the show notes. You don't have to listen to the whole episode. He does a daily 1 hour podcast and then followed by a live 1 hour radio show. Just incredible. I don't know how he does it. But anyway, you can listen from the 47 minute mark or so and see what I'm talking about. He refers to Milton Friedman and explains the third party payer problem. Now, I'm a Friedman acolyte and I sort of, I guess I'd forgotten about this. I hadn't heard about it in a long time. So it sort of, brought it back to mind. Bongino was using Friedman to sort of explain something else, but Friedman used the third-party payer problem, among other things, to explain why healthcare is so expensive in the United States. And basically, the third-party payer problem boils down to this. If I pay for something for me, then I care about price. And I care about quality. I'd like to get the best quality I can for a given price and the lowest price for a given quality. If I pay for something, but it's for someone else, then I care about price because I'm the one paying. Maybe I care a little bit less about quality because it doesn't directly affect me. It affects the other guy. If I pay for something for someone else and I'm using the credit card of a third party, so it's not my money, then I kind of don't care about price or quality. And that's the healthcare system. Forbes wrote a simple article summarizing Friedman's views back in 2009, and I have a link in the show notes to that. Short little article, but it's very succinct. Like I said, I guess because it's short, that makes it succinct, but it's well done. And in fact, if you look for third-party prayer problem Friedman on Google, you'll find some various little YouTube shorts that sort of describe it in cartoons and stuff, which is kind of cool. But anyway, the interesting thing and that Forbes pointed out that I did not know is that sort of the roots of our healthcare system and the third party payer part of it dates from World War II, and when there were wage and price controls. And since businesses couldn't raise your wages, if they wanted to attract employees, they had to do something else. They had to offer, what they started to do is offer healthcare insurance. By the way, this is very similar to, this has reminded me of the airline system. So back when airlines were regulated in the 70s and up until deregulation in the early 80s, The level of service on airlines was a lot higher than it is today. The quality of the food was a lot better than it is today. And that was because you couldn't compete on price, and so you had to compete on service. And so the same sort of thing happened back in World War II. If you wanted an employee, you had to offer something other than a higher wage. And so people started offering a healthcare benefit. And from that point on, it sort of caught on and everybody started offering a healthcare benefit. And that's the point from which that people in the United States started relying on third parties to pay for their healthcare. So fascinating. I guess I had never thought about where that all got started, but beyond just healthcare, the more the government spends on everything, the government gets bigger and bigger. It's buying more and more stuff. And so the more the government spends on everything, the more that problem, the third-party payer problem, applies to everything. So how does government respond to the problem of higher inflation because they're spending too much? They crush supply. So here's another story. There was an article in the Washington Post from the end of March, link in the show notes. And it says that the Biden administration is going to cap rent increases for some affordable housing units. Okay, now, I've stopped doing the trivia question, but here's a question for you. When you cap something below its equilibrium price, what happens? Econ 101, right? So you get a shortage. If you cap it, you get a shortage. And so the response to having too much inflation, which is partly caused by the third-party payer program problem in this in this area as well, is to cap rental increases, which destroys future supply. The administration will say this is a supply-side problem, and so people need to build more affordable housing. But people will not build more affordable housing. Why? Because they can't charge the rents that they need to make money on the affordable housing. So what happens next after that? After we've capped rent increases and destroying the market for building more affordable housing, well, what happens? We need more affordable. What happens? Well, the government pays for it, of course. That is the natural next step, is government will start to just simply build affordable, more affordable housing, right? And the government already kind of sort of in some ways does pay for affordable housing, but they're going to have to pay for more of it, which is the third-party payer problem again. Low-quality units at high prices. Let me give another example about government intercession causing higher prices. I probably don't need to give any more examples because you could probably name 20 of them all by yourself. But this is fun. A friend of mine, and this is not a U.S.-centric example, which makes it even more fun. A friend of mine works for the state energy company in, let's say, a European area country. And I don't want to give too many details because I don't want to get her in trouble. She's directly involved in power projects in this company. And like I say, I have to be careful about how much detail I give. But she noted to me that her government had implemented a policy that they need to increase the weighting of sustainability when they, as a category, when they're collecting bids for projects. So that, you know, when you collect a bid, you say, okay, we need, you know, XYZ, we're procuring a power station, a transformer station, okay? And so give us your bids, and, you know, you need to tell us what the price is going to be and what the quality, what the output will be and when it's going to be ready and what sustainability options you have added. And we have to consider, we are required to consider that sustainability option. So obviously that increases inflation. And I want to sort of read/paraphrase some of the snippets of what she told me. She said, in one system, in one transformer station, merely replacing the insulation medium that they use in one part of the transformer station to something more sustainable increased the price of that system by 40% on something that costs around $5 million. So it's going to increase the cost by $2 million on a $5 million system. Okay. So that's simply because they needed to, you know, the existing insulation approach is not as sustainable as a new approach. And since they have to consider sustainability, that's a really important thing, right? If they wanted to use sustainable concrete and zero emissions construction to build a transformer station, she estimates that it'll be 10 to 20% more for the cost of the transformer station. And then she observes, not to mention that utility companies are usually natural monopolies, so there's basically no limit to how much we can spend because our customers have to pay for our services. The third-party payer problem writ large. It's exactly what it is. She also notes, by the way, that the European power grid was mostly built in the 1950s to 1970s, and the grid components have roughly a 50 to 70 year lifespan. So we're due to renew large parts of the European utility grid in the next 10 to 20 years. She notes that pre-COVID, her company could order a high voltage transformer 4 years and get it delivered within 2 years. And nowadays they have to order a transformer 4 years in advance. For 2 years, her suppliers have been violating their contracts and paying the contracted penalty for doing so because it's cheaper to pay the fines than to deliver transformers at the contracted price and date. So And then in order, let's see, not only this, but in order to lower greenhouse emissions to stated policy levels and stated policy periods, they have requests for new power load that would imply a doubling of the amount of power that this state power company has to provide over the next decade, all while replacing the existing grid. So these are actual requests, not hypothetical, to double the power load in 10 years. You think it's inflationary? Think about all you've, and again, you know, with a four-year lead time, all of this stuff is happening like immediately. Unfortunately, if you live there, you know, you can just not pay if the price is too high. Oh, wait, you can't. This is government and you got to pay. It's a natural monopoly. If you want electricity, you got to pay. Yowza. Okay. So, you know, again, third party payer problem. And I'm going to come back to sort of that demand, after I take a slight side trip here, because I haven't talked about monetary policy yet, but obviously this is very, monetary policy is crucially important when we're talking about inflation. If there are large upward pressures on costs, then a monetary policymaker can help restrain inflation by restraining the money supply, right? This is a fundamental rule of inflation and monetarism, is that if you control the money supply, more precisely, you control MV, and you don't really have direct control over velocity, but whatever. If you control the money supply, that's the best expedient that allows you to control P and Q, which is nominal output, P being price and Q being real output. Okay? With such large upward secular pressures, not cyclical, but secular pressures on prices, central banks are going to have to keep money growth even lower than they otherwise would, because for a given M growth, more of it's going to go to P, price, and less to Q, real output. That is, you're going to get less productivity going forward, which is exactly the opposite of what you've heard if you are thinking about the AI revolution. And here's why. The limiting factor to output right now is not employment. It's something else. It's copper, it's lithium, it's various commodities like that. The same number of workers are going to produce less, all else being equal, because they're limited by some other factor. Now, it's hard to think about that with any given example. You know, your particular workplace, you go and you say, well, you know, obviously AI is going to improve what we do. But let's back this up. Let me give you an example. I could maybe do a whole episode on this, but output is constrained, whether you are a company or an economy, by the most limited factor, okay? So just like if you're going to make a cake and you have plenty of milk, plenty of eggs, plenty of vanilla, but you only have a cup of flour, then you can't make a cake. It doesn't matter how many eggs you have. If you don't have enough flour, you can't make a cake. If you're growing corn on 100 acres with one tractor and two farmhands, and you want to increase your output 100-fold, it doesn't help you to have 100 tractors and 200 farmhands, because they're not the limiting factor. Acreage is. Now, often, labor is a limiting factor, I mean, historically. And it is when we run out of labor, historically speaking, that inflation tends to go up in those sorts of, when the economy is in that kind of state. And that's why, historically, when the Fed wants to, that's why you hear so much now about the Fed wanting to cool off inflation by pushing the unemployment rate higher. That's not the way they talk about it, of course. But, you know, the idea is that, you know, the Fed's raised rates and they're not seeing the unemployment rate go up fast enough, and so inflation isn't coming down quickly enough. We all know that's not exactly how it happens, but that's the way they think about it. But importantly, it doesn't work that way at all if labor isn't the scarce factor. So let's talk briefly about the Fed's dual mandate, which says that they're supposed to minimize unemployment and minimize inflation. Okay, and we know those kind of tend to work against each other sometimes. But the dual mandate does not mean that these are equal weighted mandates at all horizons. Okay? There's nothing in the legislation that implies the mandates, or that describes the mandates, not just two of them, by the way, but there's nothing in that legislation that says over what time period these all have to be exercised or achieved. Because inflation has momentum and unemployment is cyclical, you maximize long-run employment by keeping inflation low and stable. Even Greenspan, who got a lot of stuff wrong, got that one right. And he used to say all the time that one of the reasons we need to get inflation down is because that's how we get employment up and unemployment down. But what if labor is not the scarce factor? Okay, so in that entire construct, we're saying, okay, labor is the scarce factor. And so part of what can cause inflation is this, demand push inflation sort of thing where you get, where you have not enough labor. And so people start, bidding up wages and so on and so forth. Again, we've talked about this on this podcast a whole bunch. That's kind of a chimera. It doesn't work that way exactly, but it's a useful way to think about, especially think about how the Fed thinks. All right. So let's suppose that one of the things that implies, if you do believe that, is that labor is a scarce factor, because if labor is not the scarce factor, then you don't really care what the unemployment rate is. Okay. So let's suppose labor isn't the scarce factor, but it's commodities are. Then your productivity as a nation is going to go down because you're going to run into constraints on output before you run into constraints on labor. And that means that the equilibrium level of inflation for a given level of money growth is going to go up, because the productivity is what determines the division between P and Q, okay? So in that case, it doesn't help to have AI, okay? AI, we talk about, we've addressed on this podcast and everywhere. The question is, how much will AI improve productivity? How much will AI, lower inflation over time? And the answer is, if labor is not the scarce factor, the answer is zero. It maybe not zero, but it isn't going to have the effect that you want to, because labor isn't the constraint. It's the power that you need to run all the AI. So in that case, nothing the Fed can do is going to change the fact that inflation will be higher for a given level of output. That decision, the division between price and real output, P and Q, that decision is made by industrial policy. So the Fed can move M, and that affects P plus Q, but how much P and how much Q is determined by industrial policy. Industrial policy is made by the government, who is here to help you by making power more expensive and more scarce as well. God save us. Okay, one final point here. I want to urge you to look at the link in the show notes for the article that I just co-authored with Bill Pichaka and Amnon Levy. You might recall Bill, you've heard that name, Bill Pichaka, before, because he was my guest in episode 60 of this podcast, Inflation and Insurance Companies with Bill Pichaka. Well, the article we just published in Insurance AUM, insuranceaum.com, takes those ideas that we talked about in episode 60 and expands them a lot. The article is called Inflation Management Opportunities in the Insurance Industry Today. And as we move into an era, not just a year or two, but an era, a period where inflation, thanks to your friends, the government, not to mention demographics and reonshoring trends, but inflation is going to be sticky at a much higher level than we've been accustomed to. And I've been talking about that for a long time. Some businesses in that kind of environment, okay, it's a bad environment in a lot of ways, but when you have volatility, when you have volatility in economic conditions, some businesses will have an opportunity to reform themselves in really socially useful and transformative and profitable ways. And insurance is one place where we have a lot of low-hanging fruit in that regard. Especially if you're in that industry, take a look at that article. Let me know what you think. And that's all for today's podcast. Please like, subscribe, refer others. I think this is a good episode. I hope you think this is a good episode. If you think it's a good episode, and if you know anybody in the insurance industry or government, send this on and get them to subscribe as well. You can contact me at inflationguy@enduringinvestments.com. And of course, I mentioned the blog. It's free at inflationguy.blog. Follow me on Twitter. Oh, sorry, X. @inflation_guy. Visit Enduring Investments if you have an inflation challenge. And most importantly, defend your money. And if inflation is coming for you, remember, you know a guy.